Welcome to the Joy of Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Dr. James Taylor. On this podcast, we explore the passion and purpose of leadership. Join us to explore lessons in leadership that demonstrate how you can live in the center of God's will. All right. Hey, it is my privilege to have Trey Lewis on The Joy of Leadership. Trey, great to have you here, man.
Such an honor. Thank you.
Hey, listen, I would love to start our time together and talk about what you were doing in this massive arena, super, super important arena of rehab. Your agency, Good Landing Recovery, is making a massive impact into hundreds and thousands of lives in our area. So give me kind of a nutshell about where you guys are right now. And we're going to press rewind and kind of start up from the inception. But I'd love to hear about where y'all are right now. Kind of what does this look like?
Yeah. Thanks for that. And so right now at three separate locations, we have over 100 staff. To include a medical director who is a former surgeon who did a fellowship in addiction medicine, who's also the dean of the Georgia Medical College Addiction Medicine Program, who oversees our five nurse practitioners, full-time nurse practitioners,
fantastic,
our four contract nurse practitioners, our 20 master's level therapists, and all other, you know, RNs, LPNs, techs, admin staff. So that's what's going on right now as we speak. We have 300 patients divided between the three locations.
Okay.
We have the full continuum of care, which makes us the largest standalone privately held program in the United States.
In the United States.
Period. Not faith-based. Everybody is always like, largest faith-based, and I love that, but it is across secular and faith-based space, to my knowledge.
Where are the three locations?
So two in Decula.
Yeah.
So I've got a women's program and a men's program within 5 minutes of here. And then I've got 56 acres out in Gainesville that used to be the old Christmas tree farm and then was an adolescent program. And then we bought it from the adolescent program. And so now that is where our detox and residential. And then we've got site plans for two 40-person dorms. We're going to do equine therapy, chapel, and building that place out right now.
Now, right now, your residential program is truly residential, right?
Truly.
I mean, it's really in homes.
So yes. So we've got, I don't know, 55-ish apartments that are rented all over Gwinnett County.
Okay.
That we have, which is called sober living, which is the new trendy way to say halfway house.
Right.
But ultimately, it is the structure of somebody who has gone through a program, who still needs some support, you know, not quite ready to go back home, but is just in that in between. And then we provide a very strong outpatient program. And so we can do that, but then we also have virtual, so we can serve, you know, assuming that they have, you know, telehealth benefits.
I love that.
We can deliver anywhere in the United States.
I mean, and really being able to meet any patient, any person struggling with addiction, you can meet them where they're at.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Across the board. I mean,
absolutely unbelievable. Tell us a little bit, just because your guys' approach is vastly different than almost anything I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. Give us an idea on that approach and how that's different.
Well, I think understanding that whenever you say rehab or drug and alcohol treatment, that when you know everybody has a different picture of
that.
You know, some people are thinking, "Oh, that's a 1-year program. They do 2 hours of Bible study in the morning and then the guys go out and they work on cars the rest of the day,
program,
or they,
blah, blah, yeah.
Yeah. And that's a great model for the right client. But ours is a true medical clinical program. So we're governed by the Department of Community Health. We also have a CARF certification, which is a standard of care, but we're a full medical facility. And, you know, that's why whenever I brought up the doctors, the nurse practitioners. So for example, let's say you got, you know, somebody that comes in, they're an alcoholic and they're also addicted to benzodiazepines, then, you know, pretty obvious that they're self-medicating an anxiety disorder. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So if you don't treat that anxiety disorder, I mean, you're putting them at a major disadvantage.
That's right.
Of just saying, hey, let's just pray this thing away and, you know, you know, go work on some more cars. Like that person needs to have a fighting chance.
That's right.
There
has to be a medical foundation to allow the spiritual side to work.
Sure.
Right.
I mean, God will work through a doctor like he will in a service.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So cutting edge rehabilitative therapies that are taking place. I wanted to wet the whistle of the audience here just a little bit,
yeah,
just so that they knew, like, hey, listen, this is something you need to listen to. So we're gonna put a pin in that and come back to it, I promise.
Okay.
I would love to, just because your story is powerful. You know, you're a guy who got into this. You've got just such a great spirit from an entrepreneurial perspective, from a medical perspective, and also just with a pastor's heart, man. I just love it. Give us a little nutshell on kind of why you even got into this field.
Yeah. So I was raised in North Mississippi, went first through 12th grade to a school very similar to Hebron. And, I think you guys are amazing, better, but this was the version that I went through, right, whenever I went through. And,
Christian schools still have broken kids.
That's right.
They just do.
That's,
man,
exactly,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And, you know, my parents divorced whenever I was five. It had a tremendous impact on me. And, my mom was diagnosed with, bipolar with psychosis. Mm. And, so it was a crazy, crazy environment and atmosphere that I was raised, whenever I was with her, whenever she would have visitation. And so obviously, you know, that impacted my life. There was a lot of addiction on both sides of our family. So I feel like that I was genetically predisposed, mm-hmm, as well. Started drinking, like, you know, many, you know, middle school, high schoolers, you know, tried it. And the second that I got drunk for the very first time, it cured me. So I thought it took away all my inhibition. I felt like that I'd finally found the secret recipe of what, mm-hmm, made me feel normal. So it wasn't this campaign to say, hey, I'm a bad kid and I want to go just be bad. I just felt like that I discovered something that allowed me to feel normal. So it was really more in my pursuit of normal. But when that happened, I mean, I was all about, you know, academics. I was vice president of National Junior Honor Society. I was all about sports. But the second that I did that, all that other stuff took a back seat. I still participated.
How old were you at that time?
That's right, 14,
15. 14,
15, okay. Yeah. And, yeah, and so that's what set the trajectory of my life at that point. And then I would really seek out the illicit drugs. I mean, I was just up for whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't this thing of, you know, this peer pressure or anything like that. I mean, I would see guys, whether they were older or they seemed like they were cool, they were having a little more fun than I was having with the alcohol. And I was just open to it. You know, real popular kid, people liked me. And then next thing you know, I mean, I was off to the races. Summer going into my senior year, you know, I tried LSD, I tried cocaine. And then that was another thing too, is that, you know, being raised in a Christian school, heavy on drug awareness, DARE programs, all of that, I mean, had me terrified of these illicit drugs. And when I went out, you know, I mean, I did it and, you know, went to sleep that night, woke up the next day, didn't fiend for it, you know, didn't wake up in a trash can. So I'm thinking, what's the big deal?
Like, they've been vastly exaggerating the implications here. Yeah, right.
And then somehow barely finished my senior year, went from where I was whenever I got introduced to alcohol to graduating, you know, towards the bottom of my class. But
so the grades took a real plummet during that period of time. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, my parents are typically the last ones that want to admit it. I graduated from high school going into that summer, and 2 days before I was supposed to move into the dorms at Mississippi State University, my family did an intervention. And, you know, that was the first time that I got confronted with the fact that I had a bad drug problem. I didn't realize it. Okay. You know, it's not like you're just sitting there one day and you just realize, like, oh, man, I'm addicted to this thing. I mean, it just kind of slowly happens. And I'm just oblivious to, I'm supposed to be going to college, mm-hmm, and I'm fully entrenched in this other lifestyle. And then my family intervenes, and I was so mad. I mean, I was livid.
Literally full-on intervention.
I mean, I look out my window one morning, and then here comes my dad, here comes my grandparents, here comes my aunt, here comes my uncle.
Yeah.
I am thinking, what in the world? So at this point, I mean, I'm addicted to methamphetamines, you know, and, you know, I just... You know, I just was just kind of blown away. And I remember whenever they said, you know, hey, it's either you're getting ready to go to treatment or you're getting ready to go to jail. And I was so mad. I yelled at them. I'm sure I used profanity. It was ugly. And, you know, I went back into to my bathroom where I had some drugs and got high. And honestly, I was like, all right, let's go. And
so you got high just before you went into rehab.
Oh, yeah. Right before I went into a hearing to mandate me to go to rehab.
Wow.
because they knew there was a good chance that I was just going to leave and go off on a run. And so they leveraged, you know, whatever loss that they could to make sure that I didn't go kill myself. And I think that's one of the big myths too, that, you know, I'll hear families say a lot of times, it's like, hey, we've got to wait until they're ready.
Right.
And while that's textbook and you know, you wish that was the narrative, but the reality is, it's like somebody like me, it was never going to be my idea to get help.
Yeah.
I mean, I was never going to come home. I was never the kid that ever showed up, was like, hey dad, I got a problem. Let's go get, I mean, they would do for me what I would not do for myself. And then when I would sober up, get back the ability to be able to choose and think and reason again. Right. That's when I'm saying, hey, right. Thanks for doing for me what.
You know, there's such a cop out in this area, right? Where there's a lot of research that talks about, you know, entry level, there's an entry level drug, you know, and now there's a lot of legalization with a lot of entry level, like things that they'd be called entry level for a long time,
sure,
like pot. You know, and so now you get these legalizations of pot and then you'll have people come out and say, oh, listen, there's no statistical proof that says that there's, you know, any, that there's an entry level drug that's going to lead into this other thing. But you know where they always miss is this idea that it comes down to attitudinal, right? That if you get accustomed to the idea of being intoxicated, that leads to the becoming accustomed to high, and one high leads to another high. I mean, it's like almost everybody that I've ever dealt with who's dealt with addiction has gone through this kind of step-rated path, you know, that starts out, you know, do you see that in who you're dealing with as well?
100%. Yeah. 99. The only time that I think I've seen one case where there was an RN who came into our program but again, had started with marijuana.
Right.
And then one day that was on the job, decided to shoot a K4 Dilaudid and went straight from marijuana, skips the cocaine, skips the meth, skips everything else and goes straight IV. But I'm telling you, yes, probably shouldn't even tell that story. But the reality is that the far majority, it is a stair step.
That's right.
I'm breaking down your systems of what you believe is off.
But there's such this lie, right, that's out there. I've been so intrigued. My field's education, and so I try to track education trends and see different things. But one of the really interesting trends that I saw, when we look at kind of states that have permitted pot in legalization, one of the earliest states in there was Colorado. So I've been fascinated following Colorado. When Colorado legalized pot, they were rated number 3 in the entire nation. So they're the top three best states from an educational output perspective. They are one of the very first states to legalize pot, and now they're the second lowest.
Wow.
In the entire nation, right? Oh, pot doesn't impact. Pot, people can, and listen, it does, right? So we see these consequences. We see these pieces, whether it's somebody who starts with alcohol, then leads into something else, or starts with pot and leads into something else. It becomes that attitude of addiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that addiction is such an attitudinal piece that you have to break that kind of proclivity towards an addictive personality almost, right?
Yeah, right.
You know, and in some cases, you know, I've watched guys who have come through and they've had to substitute almost like one addiction for another. I've got a good friend who's dealt with a lot of struggles, but he's diesel, man. Like he's really like he's substituted being physically fit. And now he's finally starting to balance out what does that mean to do this in a healthy perspective,
yeah,
not in an addictive way,
yeah,
you know? And I mean, pretty fascinating. So, but it doesn't stop there, right? At this one time for you with your family.
Oh no.
Yeah.
Oh, it went 10 treatment centers.
Right.
4 DUIs and just every line in the sand, you know, I'll never do this. I'll never do this. I'll do this, but I'm not going to do this. I mean, I crossed, you know, just about every single line that you can cross to find myself in a place where I could not believe the person who I'd become.
Mm. Was there a turning point? And if so, what was it?
Turning point as in turning around?
Yeah. Like, oh, was there a point where you say, boom, that's it. That's the point where, you know, I'm going to turn away from this kind of tragic lifestyle.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and I think there were real attempts along the way. And, you know, some of it was my own pride.
Sure.
But some of it was such a foreign concept. Like, I remember going into my first treatment center. I'm 18 years old. And I'm sitting there talking with some guy that's like, hey, I've lost, you know, 2 wives, 3 houses, you know, amounts of money that I couldn't even get my mind around. And I'm just sitting over there thinking, like, you know, I'm still spending dad's money
right.
at the bar. And, you know, and I'm like, look, dude, like, you know, great story, but I'm not you.
Yeah.
Like, that's never going to be me. And then also this idea of living life sober when everybody that I knew had a life that revolved around alcohol at some level. I mean, it wasn't all just, you know, wild and crazy partying. And it was in any time that I would relapse, I would never go straight back to my drug of choice. What I would say is that, man, I don't want that life. Mm-hmm. I just want to go put a suit on and go drink some champagne and hang out with my buddies at a wedding or whatever it might be, except, you know, they would go home at 11 o'clock at night and, you know, and I'd end up staying up for 3 days.
So. Right. Nuts.
Yes.
And so I know that you had a situation, even in the military, right? Where you, where you had somebody kind of reach into your life and kind of speak truth into you and spot the good in you when a lot of people hadn't seen it.
Yeah. That was a big turning point in my life. And so, you know, when that happened, I'd gotten a DUI, I was in the Air Force. I really had joined the Air Force in this kind of last ditch effort of maybe I'm lacking discipline. And maybe
that's going to be the answer.
Yeah. Uncle Sam's going to fix me.
Right.
And I got there and, you know, there's a saying, wherever you go, there you are. And unfortunately I brought Trey with me and nothing changed. And so I'm still doing the same thing. I get this DUI. I mean, it's pretty much a career ender in the Air Force. And I was attempting to get sober and the command chief master sergeant, who is the highest enlisted rank on the base. I mean, just an arm full of sleeves and stars. And I mean, just, I mean, this guy, you know, I mean,
he's done it.
Oh man, when he walks in, I mean, you just, it is just all the authority. And he saw me in an event one night and he said, Airman Lewis, he goes, I see leadership on your life and I want to mentor you. And I knew that he did not know that I was the guy that had just gotten the DUI. And so after he said that, I stopped him outside and I said, hey, Chief, I just want you to know that I'm the airman that just got the DUI. And I was expecting him to be like, oh, I didn't realize that,
write
man.
You off.
Yeah, just, you know, go handle that in your life. You know, we'll reconnect and kind of blow me off. And he goes, I don't care. He goes, I see leadership on your life. Meet me in my office.
Wow.
And when I walked into his office and this guy that had that much authority, you know, that's believing in me when, I mean, I am like the stain on the Air Force. I mean, they put it up at the front gate.
Do they really?
Oh, I had to apologize it to, you know, 300 people, not a seasoned speaker. I mean, it was terrifying to get up and, you know, read some public apology. And but that was really where God got a hold of my life. He used that man to speak life into me and call stuff out of me that I did not see. And, you know, I joined a really solid church, college and career group. I mean, we'd show up on Saturday nights and, you know, they'd teach the Bible for, you know, 2-3 hours. And I mean, it was just a remarkable time in my life.
Was that the spiritual transformation period for you?
Oh, 100%.
Okay.
That was a turning point.
And is it something where you have to then at that point in time, just, hey, I'm cold turkey at this point in time. Like, I'm not having the glass of champagne because I know where that leads to for me forever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in that, like, so how old were you at that point in time?
I was 25.
Okay. So you've gone through like 11 to 12 years of that kind of behavior up to that point in time. Man, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Were there relationships during that period of time that you permanently damaged that still are damaged today?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, you know, some of them, you know, were... I mean, I feel like family has been really forgiving and it's been restored, but it's different.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, all that stuff is different. It's no an indictment on the family. I mean, it's just, I mean, I own a treatment center. I mean,
right.
you come in my program and fail 4 or 5 times. I mean, I'm starting to wonder, like, is there any, you know, can,
right.
or maybe you need somewhere else to go. And I think, you know, you just do so much damage. You know, friends of mine, their families. I mean, some of those were tough. And I think they're all, you know, fans and have seen the legitimate change
right.
and would probably entrust other people to come to me to get That's well
right.
now.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, there is kind of a sadness on some of those relationships that really were broken.
It's like the long-term impact. Like, you know, having been in youth work for a long time, you know, I've dealt with a lot of kids that I really love, like really love and care for. To watch them head down this road.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get to a point where you can't trust their word. You almost can't trust anything other than just, I just want to see it in the long haul.
Yeah.
You know? and so that's the challenge, right? Is to say, how am I going to be impacted for the long haul? Tell me about how faith changes your program.
Yeah. So faith is the game changer. You know, I went through a bunch of treatment centers, and I probably could have got clean at any of them. But one thing that's very popular in recovery is this idea of a higher power. And I philosophically understand where some of them are coming from of like, hey, they don't want Jesus jammed down their throat and they don't want to hear about that. But like in that line of thinking, what it allows to do is for somebody just to make up some God.
Right.
You know, like, oh man, I love the love and I love the grace. Don't like the judgment. You know, don't touch my immoral relationship. Don't touch this. And me and God, you know, and I'm like, hey, that's all fine. It's 72 degrees and life's perfect. And you're in some meeting. And, you know, the guy over there with the blue hair just came up with the cool, you know, what you think is the forward thing. And I'm like, but when it all hits the fan, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. that doorknob or whatever it was that you just came up with or yeah. the synergy of the group, like that's not going to help.
That's right.
And I think for us, it's just saying, hey, we're unapologetically Christian.
Right on.
And of just saying that Jesus is who he is. And then we spend a lot of work on saying, hey, maybe there was some spiritual abuse. Maybe you did get this false idea that, you know, God is this angry old white dude up in the sky, this cosmic killjoy that hates fun. And as we reintroduce them to that, what their purpose is, their identity, he's the one that made you. He knows what's going to fulfill you the most. Mm-hmm. And people come in there. I mean, we get a lot of PKs, you know, that are just, I mean, they're done with it. They don't want to have anything to do with it. And then next thing you know, they're falling in love with Jesus, you know, sometimes right. for the very first time.
And that's what, you know, no matter what, it's that idea of the redemptive power of Christ that you can't fake it. I mean, once it happens, it truly happens. You can look at this in rehabilitation. You can look at this even in prison sentences with yeah. recidivism. Like when you see somebody who's truly come into contact with who Jesus Christ is, they've understood that he died on the cross for our sins, for that person's sins, that we don't deserve it, and yet he heaps grace upon us. Yeah. And it's really like that conscious realization that transforms. And there, what I love too is Romans 8 talks so heavy about the idea of there's nothing that can separate us from the love of God. And when I was going through my hard years as a teenager, that was the section of scripture that was just, it was so edifying. It was so life speaking into my world that I had almost bought this lie when I was 17, 18 years old, that the mistakes of my youth would somehow prohibit me from being of any service to him later on.
Oh yeah.
You know, and then you get into this, the depth of the idea of the reclamation of Christ, that he can step in and reclaim your life. And that it, like, it sticks, man, it works. Like it's not just some higher power. It's not this idea of, hey, follow these umpteen steps, but it's a true heart transition.
That's it.
You know,
and that he can redeem every bit of it.
Yeah.
To almost like it was part of the story.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd sit over there now and walk in and just say, man, this was, drug addiction was not God's plan for my life, but his ability to be able to restore and use it all, and to think of just the caliber of people that he's entrusted to say, hey, I'm giving you the most broken and the most vulnerable, and this absolute train wreck of a decade plus of your life and all the embarrassment, all the shame, like, I've redeemed it, and I'm going to use that as a platform to help other people, to bring glory to my name, and to be full-time employment mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and good employment.
Yeah.
You know, where I mean, you know, and to your point of like, and I think that's what I spend so much time of just saying, hey, you're not a second-class that's citizen. Right. Like, you are not second class. Like, this is a rough season of your life, not the coolest chapter of mm-hmm. your book, mm-hmm. but.
You know, I went through this period, man, where I was like, I was so amazed with God's grace, and it hit me. I was probably 2 years into my faith journey. I accepted Christ when I was a senior in high school, and I was probably 2 years into my faith journey, and frankly, I was still kind of pretty down on myself, like, the mistakes that I had made with alcohol, drugs, relationships. And I thought, you know, I mean, I would regularly pray this prayer, like, you know, Lord, why would you permit that to take place in my life? You know, like it's his gig, not mine, you know? Yeah. And it wasn't until I was about 2-3 years into the journey and I recognized what the Lord's calling on my life was going to be. And I've spent the last 35 years of my life working with teenagers who, guess what, are super broken.
Yeah.
You know, and I was amazed that literally the exact broken parts of my life, God has actually allowed those broken things, those mistakes, those journeys down the wrong trail, literally for me to take those parts and to speak truth into the life, into the lives of kids who are dealing with the same struggles, right? Yeah. Literally, God takes the broken parts and allow them to be the springboard for ministry, the springboard for change. And that's, man, you're like the picture of it.
Man, I mean, just to think, I mean, even in this academic setting, private school, it would be so easy for the person, like, you know, that doesn't have our background to say, like, man, those kids got it made.
Right.
Like, it's easy. They got it made. They got high-level families. You know, they got plenty of money. They get on vacation wherever they want to. And, I mean, it's just, I mean, the brokenness.
Yeah.
Yep. And yeah, thank you for saying that, and you as well.
You know, it's just that, I am continually amazed. Frankly, I still am. Like, I still, the other part that I think is a great kind of byproduct of that recognition is that I'm just not a finger wagger. Like,
yeah.
I'm not, you know, like, I feel like, who am I to wave a finger at anyone?
Yeah.
You know, I shouldn't be where I am. And yet, because of what he's done for me, that I have the privilege every day of being at this phenomenal place that's really trying to authentically minister for Christ, you know?
And who better? I mean, when I think about, you know, 16, 17-year-old Trey Lewis,
yeah,
that's struggling, like, to have a leader that would be able to see through the brokenness,
right,
and to be, you know, I mean, who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows how that literally that interaction could, you know, change 10, 15 years of...
As I hear your story, man, the one part, I think who's missing you? Like, you know, watching this kid who's talented and he's got good grades and he's an athlete and all this stuff, and watching your grades tank and things like, who's missing you? Like, mm-hmm. What, you know, why is somebody not speaking truth? And frankly, that's such a big challenge, you know, in any environment when you're saying you can't let a kid slip through the cracks.
Yeah.
Like, you gotta love every kid. And frankly, when we're most broken is when we're trying to push the people who we know have the answers, and that's who we're going to push away hard fast.
For sure.
You know, because we don't want it. You know, sometimes we just like to wallow. You know, we like to wallow in our depravity.
Yeah.
And you almost don't want the change.
Exactly. And then too, on the front end of it, it's fun.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. You know, I mean, I think that was, you know, part of it was like, yeah, I was broken, and yeah, I made some bad choices, but it was, at least in those beginning seasons, I didn't realize that this was a doorway to a prison that I would spend forever trying to get out of.
Great way to state that. Yeah, I like that. That's the doorway to the prison. It's the prison of sin. It's the prison of being absent from Christ.
Yeah.
You know, that's the worst part. I've heard several preachers talk about the idea of what is hell, you know, that it's a literal place, but we recognize that really the worst part of hell is just the absence from God.
Yeah.
You know, that it's that we are absent from him, you know? All right, take me to this kind of spot where you're in and out 10 different times, like life is pretty rocky. Dude, when does it happen when you say, I'm going to start a company for rehabilitation? Like, just walk me through that journey a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, you know, interesting. I mean, I think always, you know, I've got a certain gift mix, right? And whether I'm using drugs or I'm living for the Lord, it just depends on what control that I'm under of if either people are going to do a whole lot of bad or I'm going to get people to do a whole lot of good, right? Mm-hmm. So I was very evangelistic either way. And so when I'd get on fire for the Lord, you know, at different times or kind of get excited, then you would see that. And there was always something in me that wanted to help people and to do something in ministry. I mean, I cut my teeth in homeless shelter ministry, mm-hmm, and going to trailer parks after I got saved. And I just was convinced that if God could save me, he could save anybody, anywhere, right, anytime. And, but I wasn't ready then, you know, I mean, when you talk about, you know, this Joy of Leadership podcast, you know, the Trey Lewis that started a Bible study on Vandenberg Air Force Base, where three people showed up and they were probably just there, not because I was a good orator or a good Bible teacher, but just because they probably, you know, were my buds, was not the same Trey Lewis that could start a for-profit entity and run a healthcare facility. And so I think along the way, there was this desire. And then, you know, God would just strategically put me in different places so that I could learn more leadership, so that he could reinvent me. And eventually I went to go work for this company called Start Church, and they did 501c3 compliance, and I would do a tax law and compliance seminar all over the United States. And so I just couldn't learn it for the sake of presentation. I had to learn that area of law at a really deep level. I mean, CPAs, attorneys in the crowd, you know, paying all this money to come that we're going to drill down. I mean, there was a live Q&A, so I couldn't.
Right, you couldn't fudge it.
Nope, you couldn't fudge it. And so anyway, it was in that I started to gain an appreciation for First Amendment protection, that I could have a business to understand hostile legislative or hostile legislation that was negatively impacting the church. And in that, I would learn, hey, how is it impacting for-profit entities, et cetera. And so eventually I get a phone call in March of 2018. And March of 2017, God's already stirring in my life, hey, I want you to do something, you know. And it was just this tension I was living in. And I get a phone call from a guy named Bobby Humphrey, and he calls me and he said, Trey, what are you doing with your life? And honestly, I heard it as an insult. I'm like, what do you mean, what am I doing with my life? Like, I'm making over six figures, flying around first class. People are, you know, just, I mean, I'm a, you know, this is where I came from type deal. And he's like, no. He's like, that's not what I meant. He goes, I just believe that God has so much more for you, and whatever that is, I want to get behind it. And he had a dream years before that God was going to use him as a catalyst to start for-profit entities that were going to fund the kingdom, to fund missions. And so, again, whenever you think about, you know, most treatment centers, I mean, I would be here in front of you today being like, hey, write me a check so we can stay alive, you know, or whatever. And so now we're able to do frontline ministry and then give, you know, 25% of our distributions go to fund the kingdom. So last year, I mean, we gave away over $1 million liquid out of, while doing this, we're still able to give away to ministries, you know, to be able to preach the gospel overseas, et cetera. And it's just such a, you know, I didn't understand that, you know, that this was even possible. You know, God showed us and showed me, and I went and toured and figured out this model, this healthcare model, you know, to where we could do it. And I'm not somebody that I would say, hey, you know, just sometimes, man, you just see a kid. I mean, they're 17 years old, they're selling shoes, they're doing all this stuff. You're like, you know, they're an entrepreneur. I was not that. I was not a drug dealer, though I sold some drugs, but, you know, I just liked the product too much. I never was, like you would say, like, oh, that guy's going to start a business. And then whenever I was getting ready to form the legal entity for Good Landing, I was leaning more towards 501c3 because that's what I knew, you know, like I just knew how to raise money. I knew how to do all this stuff. And when I felt the Lord leading me, it scared me because I just didn't have really a grid for what that was. And, you know, I trusted him and we did it. And, you know,
I can't believe that was only 7 years ago.
Crazy.
I mean, it's unbelievable where the Lord's taken you in that period of time.
Yeah, less than 7 years ago. And it was two part-time staff and one client. And now we're at 300 clients, patients, and over 100 staff.
Unbelievable. Is Bobby Humphrey still involved in it?
He is. He's still involved. Yeah. We just had dinner a couple of weeks ago. We have an award that we do at our Christmas party that just really just to acknowledge his character and, you know, his sacrifice to get this thing off the ground. But yeah.
That is awesome. He's like a spiritual compass.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. Hey, so you also took it upon yourself that you guys have a church that's going out of your place as well.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that, man.
Yeah. Thanks, man. It's not a real church. Like we don't like, you know, do an offering or anything like that, but we call it Recovery Church, and we do it on Friday nights before they go on pass. And the reason that we do that is that's normally where the wheels come off the thing. Mm-hmm. So we want to bring our most powerful, most impactful event of the week. I mean, live worship, we do testimonies, we celebrate clean time. So right on the street, every Friday at 4:30, we've got people that are traveling, that have graduated our program, that are picking up, you know, a year or multiple years clean. And then we go into a message that is geared to help them. But, you know, it's also just kind of getting them out of this idea of like, I don't belong in church,
right?
You know, of, you know, and I just, you know, and just in using all the stories and all the content that's in scripture to let them know that, man, Jesus loves people like you.
Yeah.
So
it's, I've got a good friend, man. She has a person come clean her house, and we've been over there a few times, And she's cleaning up. And I said, what are you doing? She said, well, you know, the person who cleans our house is coming over. I'm like, so you're pre-cleaning? Like, what are we doing? You know, she's like, well, it's so messy. You know, like, yeah. I've got to clean up. And we almost have that mindset from a spiritual perspective. Oh, like, yeah. Hey, I can't go to church, man. You don't know what kind of baggage I have. Like, man, I've got all this stuff taking place in my life. When really, Julie, that's exactly what the Lord's looking for. Like yeah. that's exactly who he's looking for. So just that idea of breaking down the barrier, because Christ is still the answer.
Yeah.
You know, and there's nothing more that the devil would want is to place that lie into the hearts of people like, hey, don't go to church, man. You can't fit there.
Yeah.
You'll never be accepted. And that idea of Christian community is so crucial.
Yeah.
You know? All right. So I've met your bride. I've met your truckload of kids.
Yeah.
So when does your wife enter into this ministry? And do you guys do that together?
It's somewhat. It is. I mean, so we've got six kids.
Yeah.
And so she's full-time mom. And she's not up there, I don't think, as much as she would like to be, but right. She has been instrumental in obviously, you know, helping to decorate and to, you know, be a part of, you know, culture and aesthetics awesome. And all that. But yeah, I mean, we're in a really good season right now. I remember whenever we started Good Landing, we had three children and we decided to start Good Landing. And then right after we did it, I heard this thing by Dobson on Focus on the Family. He's like, man, if you've got a young family, you do not even think about a startup. And I'm like, too late.
Yeah.
So it put some pressure.
It's already rolling.
I know. It put some pressure on us. And it's been, you know, amazing. I mean, for her to let me walk away from that other job and do all this.
And, you know, honestly, for you to accomplish anything big, you've got to have somebody behind you supporting the heck out of you.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, I see it all the time with my own bride. 31 years of marriage, and really and truly, I couldn't do what I do without her support as we were raising our kids, and just the pressures of that, and knowing that you've got that stability, you know, it's so crucial.
100%.
Trey, hey, listen, man, it's been great to meet you today. You're doing phenomenal things for the kingdom. Just that redemptive power of Christ that you're teaching, but you're also demonstrating it each and every day. It's just been awesome to have you on the show today.
Thank you so much. It's been an honor.
Great. Thanks, Trey.
All right.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Joy of Leadership podcast. Living in the center of God's will is a rare blessing in today's day and age. Help us share this vital story of passionate leadership. If you would like to comment on the show, or if you know someone who would be a perfect guest, contact us at thejoyofleadership@gmail.com. If you like the show and don't want to miss a single episode, make sure you subscribe on your favorite podcast platform.